Well, welcome everybody, and thank you for coming this afternoon. Welcome to the Rideau Club, and welcome on a gorgeous February afternoon. It doesn't quite seem like February. It seems more like spring days. So for a couple of our guests who are a little further south than us, it's a welcome treat. It's like this in February all the time, actually. So, right, guys? Yeah. I wanted to just take a second and introduce a few people. My name is Dave Quist. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. You probably were spammed by 1,000 emails by myself or one of my colleagues here, who I just want to introduce right now as well. Andrea Mrozek is the Manager of Research and Communication. She's been taking everybody's picture as the our latest paparazzi effort. Peter John Mitchell is our is at the back as well, is our Senior Researcher. And Derek Miedema over here on the video camera at the back is our researcher as well. I'd also like to introduce Glenn Stanton, who's our research fellows. Just wave your hand there, Glenn, as well. Glenn is from Colorado Springs, and it's great to have you in for this event as well. I'd like to thank Elwood Enns from the RBC Dominion Securities for sponsoring today's event. As many of you here know, it's impossible to put on events like this or for NGOs to operate without strong philanthropic support. And unfortunately, Elwood is not able to be here with us today, but I do thank him for his ongoing support, his interest, and his friendship to the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. Also, I'd like to thank Mr. John Williamson at the back there. Thank you very much, John. John and his office staff, were kind enough to send our invitations out to all the members of Parliament, senators, their respective research offices and staff, and so on. So without that support, we wouldn't be able to do that. So thank you very much, John, and we appreciate that a great deal. There are several other MPs here today that I met, and there might be others, so I'm not going to say their names, because if I miss somebody, then I'm going to be in the dark here real quick. But I saw several already, so thank you very much for being with us today. The IMSC exists to present credible, research-based evidence to governments, to media, to all Canadians, in fact, about the benefits of strong family, mom and dad marriages, and the benefits to society. We do this through the undertaking and gathering of social policy family research, primarily in seven different areas. Areas of family and children, family and community, education, demographics, health, marriage, and finances. And so it's with this combination of a couple of those today that we're pleased to introduce this topic. All too often we attempt to analyze problems within one silo. We try to analyze what the problem is without looking broader than that. We might look at what pensions are underfunded, and in turn, how we can actually pay more or tax less or spend more and tax more, when in fact we need to actually look a little bit broader than that. How did we get to be in this situation to start with? In order to answer these types of questions, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Bradford Wilcox. Dr. Wilcox is the director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. He's the associate professor of sociology at the University of Virginia. He's a member of the James Madison Society at Princeton University. He earned his undergrad degree at the University of Virginia and his PhD at Princeton as well. And prior to coming to Virginia, he held research fellowships at Princeton, at Yale, and at the Brookings Institution as well. Dr. Wilcox's research focuses on marriage, parenthood, cohabitation, and on the ways that gender, religion, and children influence the quality and stability of marriages and family life. His research has been featured on such august media outlets as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, BBC News, The Atlantic, Washington Post, USA Today, Boston Globe, CNN. Anybody you haven't been on, actually, Brad? It's quite a long list there. CBS News, NBC's Today Show. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, as well as the Wall Street Journal. Today's session, The Sustainable Demographic Dividend, is the first of several reports that the IMFC is sponsored with Dr. Wilcox, jointly published with eight other research institutes around the world. Most of you have already received a copy of the report or through a link in your emails, and there are some available at the back. We had a limited supply left over by the time we did distribution, but if you didn't get a copy and there's some back there, that's what they're here for as well. Following his presentation, which will last about half an hour or so, we're going to open up for Q&A from yourself, and then we'll wrap up with a little one-on-one time after that as well. I believe that Brad is one of the leading sociologists in the world today studying the benefits of marriage and family. And so will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Brad Wilcox. Thanks, Dave, for that kind introduction and for the opportunity to partner with IMC both on this report and many future endeavors as well. But I want to begin by saying that this report, which I think many of you have, the Sustainable Demographic Dividend, focuses on two central questions for our time. The first is, how do global demographics affect the world's leading economies? The second is, which sectors of the economy are most closely tied to the fortunes of the family? Obviously, these questions could not be more timely. In fact, I recently spoke to the Roman Parliament, something from Rome here to Ottawa, to discuss the ways in which demographics are implicated in Europe's fiscal travails. I think we're just coming to terms now in the West with the fundamental fact that what happens in the family doesn't necessarily stay in the family. Rather, it spills out into the larger society, including the economy, in ways both large and small, and for good and for ill. Go to the next slide there. So because one of the audiences for this report is the business sector, I'm beginning today with an executive summary that kind of gives you a sense of where we're headed today. In the first two sections, we're thinking about how it is that marriage and fertility are related to the health of the economy and the welfare state as a whole, and also the key sectors of the economy. The third and fourth parts are reflecting on the way in which particular dimensions of family life are important for the family, particularly the way in which men are affected by marriage and the way in which kids are affected by the family structure that they grow up in. And we conclude with some thoughts about how it is that both the public policy, but especially the business arena and the civic arenas, can exercise a more helpful role in strengthening the family here in Canada and elsewhere. So in terms of the first point, the fiscal crisis that is currently enveloping Europe is tied at least in part to dramatic demographic shifts. We know that almost 50% of the recent increase, the recent run-up in public debt in Western countries can be attributed to the fact that these countries are seeing a dramatic increase in the share of their population that's older. It's particularly salient in countries like Italy that have had long periods now of low fertility, which mean that they are depending for a relatively small share of workers to help and fund the older folks who are retired and living off of public pensions or getting public aid when it comes to their own health care. And this very same phenomenon in some ways is happening here even in Canada. I know you've had a recent discussion of this issue with regards to the OAS. But the point is that even in Canada you're seeing a shift because in part of dramatic declines in fertility in Canada to where the ratio of workers to elderly dependents is going from about 4.4 now to some estimates would say 2.2 by 2050 or even lower by 2050, depending upon which source you're looking at here in Canada. But the point clearly is that these demographic trends can be a source of strain for the modern welfare state. But these trends also have important implications for the broader economy. And we know, for instance, that because of these dramatic shifts in fertility in regions like Europe, regions like Eastern Asia, that we're going to see a dramatic decline in the size of the workforce. This is like China, about 21% between now and 2050. In Japan, even more dramatic, 35% between now and 2050, as well as much of Europe. And even here in Canada, once again, because the fertility rate is 1.67 currently right now, you can see just a very modest increase in the Canadian workforce between now and 2050. And a lot of that will be powered by ongoing immigration into Canada, which helps to kind of prop up the size of the Canadian workforce to some degree. And so as we think about the implications of this demographic shift, both at the kind of the policy level and at the economic level, we're going to see more and more societies that to some degree are coming to resemble what's now already unfolding, particularly in East Asia, especially now in Japan, where you're seeing a dramatic increase in the share of the population that's older. And we are seeing in the research on this that some of the trends that are now unfolding in Japan, where they've had basically economic stagnation since the 1990s, can be attributed at least in part to the fact there's also a stagnating workforce in Japan linked to the demographic trends in that country. And economists are now predicting slowing growth for South Korea and for China, these sort of classic East Asian tigers, as their own populations age and the workforces begin to shrink, of course, the course of this century. In fact, one recent report from RAND found that, quote, India will have more favorable demographics than will China, unquote, for growth by the middle of this century. So the point here simply is that these trends are implicated in, among other things, the capacity of these large-scale economies to grow in the future. So the bottom line here is that we need to, I think, we need to acknowledge on the one hand that demography is not destiny. There's factors like the education of the population, the nature and scope of state regulation, the quality of the nation's infrastructure, the efficiency of your healthcare system. All these kinds of factors play into the health of the economy. Even, for instance, in Canada, you've, I think, demonstrated some real leadership with regards to, you know, some of your public spending. The Canada Pension Plan is well funded. But even once again in Canada, the OAS may require some changes based upon the growing number of retirees and the declining birth rate in Canada. Well, this is not an issue for today in Canada. It is worthy of examination and discussion today as there are longer-term consequences. But more fundamentally, other things being equal, aging societies and shrinking workforces do not spell success for most nations. Rather, these demographic trends, to quote from the slide, portend ominous changes in economic prospects for many developed countries, major increases in public debt patterns, and slower economic growth. So we've reflected briefly on the link between these larger demographic trends and the health of the economy and the welfare state. Now we can think, too, about how economic shifts are driven at sort of the industrial level by changes in the family. And the point here is that some sectors of the economy are more likely to flourish when love is followed by marriage and a baby carriage. And in particular, our research from the States in a way suggests that adults who get married and have kids spend more money in at least seven different sectors of the economy. We'll look at this next. So on things obviously like childcare, but also insurance, household products, healthcare, food at home, which covers both agriculture and grocery stores, home maintenance, and things like pets and toys. There's a clear association between household structure and consumer spending. So these industries, for instance, in the States are more likely to flourish when people get married and have kids. So what's going on here? What's driving the link here between family structure and consumer spending and really the health of different sectors of the economy? One point, of course, is obvious, and is household size. Is that when people get married and have kids, their household size increases. They're more likely to buy in bulk. For instance, Procter & Gamble sells Bounty, which, you know, is paper towels. So if you have a bunch of kids, are more likely to be spending money on Bounty and making Procter & Gamble a wealthier company. It's also the case, too, that even when it comes to thinking about households with children, households that are headed by married parents are more likely to spend money on their kids than are households headed by cohabiting parents and by single parents, because married parents are more likely to pool their income and benefit from economies of scale compared to the alternatives. And therefore, they're more likely to spend money on their children. So companies like Disney, for instance, are more likely to benefit when adults get married and have kids than when they do parenthood in alternative ways. The third point here is that when it comes to kind of domesticity, that married parents, both with kids in the home and those whose kids have left the home, are more likely to devote themselves to home maintenance, home improvements, and to domestic activities more generally. So a company, for instance, like Home Depot, is going to do better when adults get married and have kids because they're more likely to go and make use of the kinds of resources that Home Depot sells. Yeah. But I also want to spend some time today reflecting on how it is that family life affects the investment really of half the adult population because there actually is a kind of a modest marriage premium associated with marriage for women, but this premium is more clearly articulated for men. After marrying, men work harder, they work longer hours, they work more strategically, and they earn more money as a consequence. In the U.S., for instance, we see that in the year after marrying, men work about 160 hours more than they did in the year prior to marrying. And there's an income premium that we see in countries across the world. It's relatively modest here in Canada, about 7%. But if you think about it, this is on an hourly basis, so actually still, you know, probably matters even more than this because married men tend to work more hours than their unmarried peers. But the point is that there's a link between being invested in the economy and being married for men. And part of the story here is that men are getting a new status in life, that they associate with responsibility, both for themselves, for their spouse, and often for children, that shifts their orientation towards work and towards savings in ways that make them more productive as adults. The next slide gives you a sense of how this plays out in the insurance sector. And as we go to that next slide, the basic point there is that research suggests that the sort of the top predictor of men purchasing life insurance is getting married. For women, actually, the top predictor is having their first child. So when you put those two events together, getting married and having a child, what it means is that adults, at least in the States, are more likely to go ahead and buy life insurance. So once again, it illustrates to us the way in which kind of these demographic, these family realities are deeply implicated in consumer spending and the health of particular industries. And go to the next slide, we can see that in the kind of interest of being fair here and being kind of accurate, it's important for me to acknowledge that some industries are actually likely to flourish when adults postpone marriage and parenthood. So a company like MillerCoors, for instance, is likely probably to do better, other things being equal, because young adults, particularly young men, are more likely to be spending money on beer if they're not married and they don't have kids. But other companies are less likely to flourish in our current demographic context because adults, in this case particularly men, are less likely to buy something like, for instance, life insurance when they're not married. Now, I've talked about particular sectors. I've talked about how marriage affects men. I also wanted, too, to give you a sense of how this plays out for kids, both kind of when they're children, but also as they move into adulthood and enter into the formal economy. And the basic story here is that kids who are raised in intact married homes are more likely to acquire the human and the social capital that they need to thrive, both in the larger social world, but more particularly also in the market, in ways that are listed here on the slide. And we're going to kind of go through quickly how these different points play out for young adults and for children. So when it comes to steering clear of difficulty with law enforcement, we know that boys who are raised in an intact married home are about half as likely to end up spending some time in prison or in jail in the U.S., even after controlling for differences in income and education for boys. So having a father present in the home plays a crucial role in establishing a climate of authority and discipline that helps boys kind of adhere to the straight line. But dads also matter for daughters. And what we see in the data is that girls whose dads leave before they turn six are about seven times more likely to become pregnant as teenagers compared to girls whose dads are sticking around for the duration of their childhood. So having the father there to provide attention, to provide affection, is important in helping girls have a proper appreciation for their own self-worth and not for getting into trouble with a young man or a boy who doesn't have their best interests at heart. Of course, this has implications, too, for their future ability to enter into a successful family life, but also into the workforce as well. And for both boys and girls, we know that kids who are raised in a single-parent family are about twice as likely to drop out of high school in the States. So once again, having two married parents is crucial for helping them to acquire some of the human capital that they need to flourish later in life. And that plays into college graduation rates, where, once again, kids who are coming from intact families in the States are about twice as likely to graduate from college to acquire that human capital that they need to flourish in the market. And then we come kind of to the end of this sort of economic story, and you can see that young adults, particularly young men, once again, who have been raised in a non-intact family, are about twice as likely to have an experience of being idle. This is actually looking at odds ratio, but the point is that the link between family structure and idleness is stronger for young men than it is for women. And young men who are fortunate enough to grow up in an intact married family are less likely to become idle here as 20-somethings in the States. Now, this actually is a side note, this next slide. But I think it just gives you also a sense, too, of the kind of the safety and security that a particular kind of family structure tends to impart to kids. has implications, too, for their integration, not just into the economy, but into the broader society as well. And what this next slide is going to be showing for us in a moment is that the gold standard when it comes to our kids' safety and security, and actually there's been some work done by Daly and Wilson here in Canada that kind of comes to the same conclusion, but the gold standard when it comes to children's welfare, their physical, their emotional, and their sexual safety is the intact biological married family. And I have 5 adopted kids, so I have nothing against some alternatives, but I'm just saying also as a sociologist to you today as well, that there's something special about that particular family structure. You can see here on the screen now. And this is actually from a federal report in the U.S., the 4th National Incident Study of Child Abuse and Neglect. And what you can see here is that, and this is actually their colors, not my colors, but the gold standard here in terms of the safest place for kids is the married biological parent group for physical abuse, sexual abuse, and emotional abuse. And any deviation from that pattern in the States is linked to more physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. And the most dangerous place here, here, and here is a situation typically where a child is living with a mother and an unrelated cohabiting male boyfriend. And so the point here simply is that if we're interested in creating a safe context for our kids to flourish, then we should be attentive to family structure and to the marital status of the child's parents. So it's these kinds of findings in domains like delinquency, dropping out of high school, like teen pregnancy, like idleness, child abuse, that have led social scientists to draw this kind of conclusion about what we're seeing in the data. Quote, although it was once possible to believe that high rates of cohabitation and non-marital childbearing represented little more than lifestyle alternatives brought about by the freedom to pursue individual fulfillment, many analysts now believe that these individual choices can be damaging to the children who have no say in them and to the society that enables them. So I've sketched out a number of ways, I think pretty quickly, that what happens in the family has implications for the macro welfare of the economy, for the fiscal health of the state, for the economic integration of men and then kids as they move through the life course later on into the economy. All I think designed to suggest to you that both fertility rates and the strength of marriage in a given society, including Canada, are things that we should be concerned about. So where do we go from here? And I think it is the case that at the policy level, that governments, both the federal and provincial level, can think about, for instance, public service campaigns on behalf particularly of marriage and fathers to help steer the culture in a more positive direction. We know that almost a quarter of, for instance, Canadian kids are living in single-parent homes. They can also think, too, about how public policies do or do not favor child-rearing and do or do not penalize marriage or support marriage vis-a-vis cohabitation or single-parenthood. So those things are important, but I also would say we have to recognize that civil society and especially the market have potential roles to play here. And I think oftentimes when it comes to thinking about family policy and family issues, we forget that corporate Canada, if you will, corporate America from the South, have a pretty big impact in their own spheres, in their own internal corporate culture, in their corporate philanthropy, and perhaps especially in kind of the advertising, both in terms of the content of that advertising, but also in terms of the kinds of shows and other activities they do or do not support. They should sort of think about whether or not they're using that power on behalf of a strong family culture here in Canada for reasons that we've, I think, gone through in the last few minutes. And I mentioned the point about sort of advertising and culture in part for this reason, and that is that we know from a body of emerging work both really in Brazil and in India that popular culture appears to have had a major role in many of the major demographic shifts that we've seen in the world really since World War II. Just take, for instance, in Brazil. What we've seen in Brazil is that TV was not introduced in every region of Brazil at the same time. It was introduced in different regions as they got television towers up into those regions. And they know, therefore, that there's a strong link between the introduction of television in different regions in Brazil and declines in fertility and also declines in the marriage rate in Brazil. And I think it's not just TV per se, but also particularly Brazilian telenovelas, which are quite over the top in many important respects, that are linked to these dramatic demographic shifts that they've seen in Brazil in the last 3 years. So the point here is that we should be cognizant of the way in which popular culture has played an important, indeed probably a central role in shaping the family context of our societies here in the West. And given that reality, think about what we can do to push the popular culture in a more positive direction. So businesses, for instance, like Manulife here in Canada, which is the biggest Canadian insurance company, as you well know, and depends, I would argue, in part on strong families for its bottom line, these kinds of businesses should get behind shows, should get behind ads, should get behind social marketing campaigns that are facilitating or fostering a more positive family culture here in Canada. So, but beyond thinking about the role that specific companies like Manulife can take in strengthening families, all of us need to face the fact that current family trends in both Europe and the Americas are not sustainable, simply not sustainable. Indeed, our current demographic and economic challenges present us, I think, with an opportunity to communicate some basic truths about family and the economy that have been forgotten or denied for much of the last half century. To wit, strong economies depend upon a sustainable supply of babies, because babies turn into workers, consumers, and taxpayers. Strong economies depend upon a strong marriage culture, because men are more likely to work hard and work well when they're married. And strong economies depend upon a strong system of intact marriages, because boys and girls are more likely to acquire the human and the social capital that they need to thrive as workers in the marketplace. So the bottom line message here of the sustainable demographic dividend is that business, government, and civil society should strengthen the family, because the wealth of nations and large sectors of the economy are tied to the fortunes of the family. Thank you.